Coming up on another exciting installment of That Was a Show.
Hey, have you guys seen the John Larroquette Show?
You know I have, or I thought I had.
Do I have to answer?
Cold open. We grew up during peak sitcom, Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince. But those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Berney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production.
How you doing, Barry?
You know, I'm doing all right, Aaron. I'm doing all right. How are you doing, you two wonderful folks?
Yeah, we're okay. We're living the dream here.
Pretty good, all things considered.
Yeah.
Right on, right on. It's, you know, we're a couple days into the old Biden presidency. Thank you for once again tuning into That Was a Show, where we talk, the Canadian podcast that for some reason talks about American politics.
yeah.
But that is indicative of just how much Canadians talk about American politics. That's not an us thing.
that's very true.
All right, let's just get right into it.
Okay.
Bryn, why don't you tell us about the John Larroquette Show?
Okay. So this week we're talking about the John Larroquette Show. I'm very excited to talk about this show.
Who's in that?
Well, it just happens to be starring John Larroquette.
Funny you should ask.
that adds up.
Yeah. So it was an NBC sitcom that ran from September 1993 to October 1996.
Oh.
Yeah. It had four seasons and received critical praise and awards, including several Emmys. So in many senses, it was actually a successful show. The reason it fits into our criteria here is because that it has been, unfortunately, largely forgotten. And to the majority of people in North America, it didn't really make a lasting impact. It mainly stayed on the air for four seasons because of a pretty substantial retool after its second season. It's a dark comedy starring award-winning sitcom actor John Larroquette and was created by Don Rio. The series is set in St. Louis, Missouri, and it follows John Hemingway, played by Larroquette, a recently divorced recovering alcoholic and struggling writer who manages the aptly titled Crossroads Bus Terminal. We watched the pilot and episode 17 from season 3. All right, so I chose to cover the John Larroquette Show because I thought it connected nicely with Sports Night, our last episode. Because it does a lot of genre bending and, you know, it kind of, for a sitcom, it really covers some very serious subject matter. Also, the second episode that we watched features Betty White, and Betty White just turned 99, so it would be a great way to feature our girl Betty White. Another reason why I chose the John Larroquette Show is kind of a weird personal one. Aaron has mentioned this show numerous times randomly over the years since I've known him.
He does bring this up randomly in conversation.
Yeah, it's weird. So I was like, all right, we might as well cover this because it sort of fits into what we've been discussing lately.
Okay, I might as well tell my anecdote slash admission here. This is kind of an expansion on my initial reaction that you might recall from the teaser, where I talk about how this is not the show I remember at all. And that is because for many years, ever since high school, right up until we've done this episode, I have cited this show in many, many conversations as a joke whenever I would talk about a show that I remember as having been a failed show that I thought was hilariously bad from the 90s. And my memory of what this show was is completely wrong. So all of the attributes that I would talk about in these jokes are not correct at all. So first of all, I thought that this show was a spinoff of Night Court. and that John Larroquette played the same lawyer that he played in Night Court. I thought it took place in a subway station, and it was about his interactions with the other people who populated that station during his commute to work at the Night Court.
Yeah.
So you thought it was Train 48?
Basically. And that's a
and
good
Aaron
reference.
And Aaron has brought this up, like I said, multiple times, and is always making fun of it. And I'm like, is it really about that? Like, what is
And
that?
Lastly, in my memory, it was a silly comedy, like just a straight silly comedy, very kind of cookie cutter mid-90s sitcom. And I thought it lasted like 10 episodes and was a total failure. So I could not be more wrong about all of those points.
So basically, Aaron has just proven that whole psychological phenomenon of false memories just being randomly implanted into your brain.
Yeah, this show was basically an urban legend in my mind that was not at all based in reality.
So you think this is like a mandala effect where like on another universe, there's a version of this show that is just a silly Night Court spinoff?
Yeah.
Yes, basically, yes. That is what I think.
So you didn't remember that this is a show that like wants to have a very serious conversation about race?
Yeah.
No. And I suspect what happened is, for context, at the time when this show was on, I spanned the ages of 10 to 13. And I suspect that at that young age, I caught maybe a minute of this show. And obviously, in my mind, spun some assumption of what kind of show this was based on what just happened to have occurred during the 1 minute that I saw. Because as soon as we started watching, visually, I recognized it. Like the image in my mind of what the station looked like was an accurate snapshot, as if it was one of those ViewMaster things where you just had the one static photograph. Everything else I remembered was wrong.
Which is very interesting, because you would think of all things, the look would be the thing that's skewed in your brain. But obviously you have a weird visual memory.
Yeah.
I get it, because honestly, this is one of the most beautiful sets I've ever seen on anything, period. Yeah. Sitcom or drama, whatever, the bus station set is gorgeous.
Well, also, you know, I could see why you would immediately love that too, because that's totally your thing. You're way into like film noir and like hard scrabble types of stories. Like you're just naturally a fan of that. And this definitely has that element. So
I'm not
surprised that you instantly were like, oh, it's gorgeous.
Oh, it was gorgeous,
yeah,
though. I love old buildings like that. Like it actually reminds me of the Toronto bus station a little, which is less gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess like this kind of segues into really what the show is about, at least in the first couple of seasons. You know, there's a lot of really important commentary happening. Like there is obviously first and foremost a main character who struggles with addiction and he's trying to kind of pull his life back together. And it's a dark comedy about that reality. And right from the pilot, you know, it's clear that he's having a tough time with it. So, yeah, it's a little bit on the nose that his name is John Hemingway. And he's a writer who drinks.
There's got to be a fucking bylaw about naming a writer character in something John Hemingway.
I know.
I'm so glad you both pointed that out, because my first note that I wrote down is character John Hemingway. What's the deal with the title then? Because in addition to it being weird that he's a writer with the name Hemingway, the show is called The John Larroquette Show.
But you see
this
that
is very
a lot.
Common.
Yeah,
this
you
is
see
very,
that a lot.
Very common.
It's just branding. It's just like straight up branding.
Like the Michael Richards show, he does not play a character named Michael Richards.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this is the only show that's done that. I'm just saying that I find it weird that they kept the same first name and then switched the last name, but to something incredibly cliche.
That is also always a thing. They always keep the first name. I don't know why.
So like we've said, there's elements of film noir references. It's definitely been called a sitcom noir. It's been called a tragic comedy. It's unquestionably a dark or even black comedy. exploring the main character's alcoholism and struggles to rebuild his life. But it also has a lot of commentary, as Barry mentioned earlier, about race and privilege and class, as well as stigma towards sex workers. So there's a lot going on in this show. And, you know, we see it right away in the pilot. So it opens with John accepting his new position as the night manager. And this is an important distinction. So in the first two seasons, he's the night manager at the Crossroads Terminal. And, you know, he sort of comes upon the scene and it's very, very gritty. So right away, he meets his new colleagues, Mahalia Sanchez, played by Liz Torres, and Dexter Walker, played by Daryl Mitchell. He also meets other fixtures of the terminal, like Gigi Rice, who is a high-end sex worker, and she's played by Carly Watkins. To summarize it in a real quick way, John is overwhelmed by the demands of his new role that he is obviously not qualified for. And he's also equally overwhelmed by his temptation to drink and the seedy atmosphere of the Crossroads Terminal.
One thing I'll say, in terms of the genre and tone of this show, I like dark comedies. This is probably the darkest comedy I've ever seen in a multicam sitcom.
Yeah.
And
this is the darkest sitcom I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Ever. We've talked about truly bits and pieces of dark comedy in other shows. In our holiday special, Bryn, you talked about a Married with Children Christmas episode where a mall Santa falls from the sky to his death in the Bundy's backyard. That's a great example of a joke, which is dark in a much broader comedy sense. This show is dark. This is Dr. Strangelove making fun of nuclear annihilation at the peak of the Cold War. Dark. This show is all the way. I've never seen a sitcom that went, at least in the pilot, that went this far.
Yeah. And you get the overall perspective of the show in this moment where John hangs this sign in his office that says this is going to be a dark ride. When Mahalia comments on it, she asks him what's that all about, and he's like, I got it from a carnival as a kid. I think it should be hanging at the end of a birth canal.
it's a great line, and all the characters are kind of angry at the world, and they're kind of all experiencing a lot of darkness in their days.
Generally speaking, these are all people that have been through a lot. All of their circumstances are different, but they're all at a crossroads.
Yes,
if
they
you
are.
Will. So all of the main characters that are spending most of their time in the terminal are either going through a lot or have seen a lot. They all have heavy lives. And they all are kind of street smart and they all kind of learn from each other, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, they're all struggling with their respective circumstances. And it seems like ultimately the thrust of the show, I mean, having not seen other season one episodes beyond the pilot, I can only guess at this, but it seems like the thrust is that they are all going to have to support each other, or that they are all going to be at their strongest when they support each other and when they have at least some level of understanding or compassion for each other's circumstances at this crossroads, which is almost like each of their respective crossroads in their lives, but also the crossroads of these different people.
Yeah. The way I looked at it was like, I think my brain went to this weird place where it's like, I think they're doing this with a brush that they don't sell anymore, but they're painting like a pretty distinct picture, which is just like everybody has a story. And I thought it was really interesting that, like, honestly, like all the characters in it felt like they were living their own dramas and occasionally intersecting with each other, but in no way were they supporting characters. Like, they all felt like they had just as much weight to like their stories going,
it's true,
at least in the background.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. That's really a good point. Yeah, it's like almost as if we are kind of with John Hemingway as a protagonist because that's where this show happens to have landed, but it feels more like the other people there are not there to be supporting characters to him.
No, nobody was teaching him lessons. Like, they were just like, he was learning shit throughout the episode, but like, nobody was there to walk, to hold his hand or walk him through it. Like, they were all dealing with their own shit.
Yeah, well, in a way, they do teach him something, but it's by putting him in his place.
Yeah.
Like, right off the bat, Dexter and Mahalia kind of call him out for his white privilege because he's completely oblivious to the fact that basically the only reason he got the job was because, you know, none of the people of color who work at the terminal that applied were even considered for this job. Mm-hmm. So he was basically hired because he's the only white guy that applied.
Yeah. And they state this in no uncertain terms. They don't kind of dance around this. It is explicitly in the dialogue.
Yeah. So they call him out for his like obliviousness and his privilege and the fact that he's like not even qualified really to take this job whatsoever. And there's a point where, you know, where John is having an exchange with Dexter, and Dexter is like kind of really sticking it to him about this. And John, it seems like he's about to get sort of defensive about it. But then he's like, okay, no, I can't be defensive about this. And then he makes a joke. So, you know, which is something that would be really relevant today.
Interesting to see in 93.
Exactly.
That a guy actually like checks his white privilege and shuts up. Yeah. I was like, not where I saw this scene going.
Yeah. I think it would be valuable for a lot of people to see now.
It is a very relevant show today. And so Dexter operates the kind of food counter in the bus terminal there. And there's a couple of police officers that frequently loiter on the stools at this counter. They make a joke about racism and bias in policing. And there's also commentary in this show, obviously, as you said, about bias and racism in the hiring practices of whatever company runs this bus terminal. And it is one of those things where it's hard for us to deconstruct what was the editorial intent of the writers or showrunners when they created some of these moments.
I think it's worth actually saying what the joke was. I really do.
Yeah.
It's dark, and I will preface it with it's dark, and I can't believe this was ever a joke on network television, let alone on NBC's Must See Thursday. But the joke is essentially, so the two cops are leaving and they're about to pay, and Dexter says, no, your money's no good here. And one of them says, this is great. You know, that's going to decrease the likelihood of us accidentally shooting you. And then they follow that joke up even more by saying they'd already done it before and claimed that it was dark.
Oh, I didn't pick up on that.
I don't even know if I picked up on the follow-up joke.
That's rough.
Really? Oh, my God.
I was probably too busy picking my jaw off the floor from the first joke.
Yeah.
Yes, that is the follow-up joke. They had already done it before. And their excuse and the reason they got away with it before is they claimed it was dark.
Ooh. And I mean,
Dexter's
reaction is great as well, because he's just kind of gives them a dirty look.
Yeah.
He's just like, you know, it's basically a fuck you look as they walk
away. And he calls them like no good freeloaders or something like that.
After they leave, which is very, very justified.
So I know I'm skipping ahead and I'm only going to do it as a small point here, but it's relevant to this conversation. I'm assuming when we get to talking about how it was retooled later, one of the things I thought was interesting is I accidentally started watching another episode of season 3, which I am known to do, is to randomly start watching the wrong episode. And I noticed that the cops were still there. They were now regulars. And I was just like, oh, these despicable humans get to be sitcom characters. Interesting.
Yeah.
As soon as I heard these jokes from the cops, and they only play briefly in the pilot, but as soon as I saw that, I immediately thought, are these cops going to be a running gag in this show? And is that purpose going to be strong commentary where we are clearly not on their side? Or is it going to turn this into something frivolous and silly? And I just haven't seen enough of this show to know one way or the other.
There's your answer. They become frivolous and silly.
Yeah.
They do become frivolous and silly.
Which is not great.
No, no.
Yeah, and Aaron, the one thing you mentioned to me just before we recorded, it's like, is it good commentary? Like, we like the commentary because we feel like we're interpreting it to show that all of this is bad. But was that the intention? And was the intention for us to identify with John Hemingway, or was it to be like, oh no, he's an arrogant dick?
Yeah.
You know, like what?
And it's hard to know.
In the pilot, I do, it's commentary. It is full on commentary. It's biting commentary. It is literally talking about something that would not have been okay to talk about in 1993. Yeah. And that's why I'm surprised it made it to air. Is it a funny joke? Nope. Is it important? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think it, you know, just that conversation being had in a living room in the early 90s is not something I can imagine.
Right, totally.
Yeah,
and like Dexter, like he is just a vibrant character with like a story that I kind of wanted to see more of.
He could have had his own spinoff and that would have been great.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I could see, if you know, in a version of the show that completely works, just as much time is devoted to him.
If we are to assume that the show that we're seeing in the pilot is the intention of what this show was trying to be before other factors came into effect that pulled it this way or that, then it does, I agree, seem like they were going for strong, biting commentary and that we are not just supposed to be on John's side.
Yeah.
That he is, if anything, supposed to be a surrogate for us, the audience, who need to learn a damn thing about some of the other perspectives that John gets in this bus station.
That's a good point.
I mean, I don't see it as a being on his side or not. I mean, I think the show very much knows that he's a very flawed man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
fair.
And he's learning, right? I don't think necessarily like he's supposed to represent arrogance or anything like that. I mean, his character shows just as many signs of hidden depth than that as well, right? He's a complex character, right?
Yeah, and incomplete. The thing about this show is it definitely treads in some territory thematically that is challenging, and it makes jokes in a very dark way out of some really serious subjects. And when I think about some of the most successful sitcoms of the same era, those shows never took the risk of being tone deaf or tackling one of these subjects the wrong way because they just ignored them. If you think of the way this show talks about race, a show like Full House or Cheers never talked about it because that just did not exist in those shows. Mm-hmm. Or some of the other subject matter like addiction or any of the other struggles that these characters have, that this show enters a part of society that most sitcoms at the time didn't even try. It would be easy for us to criticize this show for the moments where it doesn't handle one of these themes in the best possible way, but how do we compare that to other shows from the time that are considered very successful, yet those shows never even tried?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think this show was interesting in having a conversation, whereas I don't think most shows weren't. I mean, hey, we're big Seinfeld fans. We all love Seinfeld. But like when Seinfeld brought up serious issues, they were kind of being cute about it. They weren't really talking about it. They were being cute, right?
Yeah.
Like, so this wants to have a conversation.
So, you know, we talked a lot about the themes that came up in the pilot right away. But what about some of the other weird plot points that happen in the pilot?
There's a lot going on. The pilot is essentially like a three-act play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like, it just keeps moving. Keeps moving.
It does. It moves quickly. I agree with that. For something that's sort of like a sitcom noir, as they call it, it does move very quickly. And there's this weird plot where basically John has to solve this big issue with one of the buses on one of their routes where it's delayed because there's a woman giving birth and there's someone with a like a kidney transplant or something. Like, what is going on with the... That's the one thing I got very confused about.
I believe what's happening is that there is a donor organ,
right,
presumably in some sort of cooler bag, that is correct, being transported on this bus.
Why would it correct be on a bus? A public bus?
Because they, for some reason, the man transporting it, like Doris Roberts has, The kidney wasn't on the bus. The guy getting the transplant was on the bus.
Oh. Right.
Doris Roberts paid for, so, oh, I'm sorry, sorry. Randomly, Doris Roberts shows up and yes, in all her glory. But she's mostly there for like dramatic plot points. Her brother is coming on a, I don't fucking know. Wait, I have no idea.
It's her husband. No, it's her brother-in-law.
The
husband's getting the transplant. The brother is coming on the bus. Her no good brother, who she paid for a first class flight for him, and he cashed in the ticket for the money and bought the cheapest bus ticket possible. on as Doris Roberts put it, your Flying Dutchman of a bus, which I thought was very, very funny.
Oh man.
Let's be honest, none of the three of us 100% absorbed what was happening there.
It was a very complicated explanation needed.
I watched the episode 2.5 times, and one of the times was like, oh, I should pay attention to this plot line. I don't understand it.
Yeah.
And I guess I still didn't.
I just cherry picked the information that I needed to like get by. Yeah. Basically, it was like John Hemingway solving a big problem that he had no experience solving. And it was kind of just a contrived plot that it would be his call as to what they chose to deal with, this important transplant
the bus driver is gonna, like, the bus driver who's delivering a baby. Yeah. I'm sure he's going to listen to the manager of the bus station.
The brand new manager.
Yeah.
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 It's funny because it's a very complicated little plot setup there. And it worked for me in the pilot because even though I clearly missed half of what was going on with that, it served the purpose of saying, this guy who's now in charge of managing this bus terminal is going to be confronted with some random,
overwhelming things.
Yeah, overwhelming random things that he's going to have to make quick decisions on. And that's really all that mattered in the context of this show from that. And then the details of what we're going on, clearly we're struggling to piece it together.
Yeah, but I think they just kind of threw it in after as probably a note where it's like, oh shit, he has to solve a problem. Like, we have to show him kind of rise to the occasion and do something. Like, that is just a trope of that kind of storytelling. Like, you do have to have that happen. Like, you do have to have the person kind of make a decision and prove themselves. And so it kind of kicks off the rest of the series. Like, they either have to succeed or fail at something to kind of set the precedent for the rest of the series. So they put that in. They put in this whole convoluted,
plot. What else did they put into the pilot? What did they just throw in there like it was no big deal? He gets fucking held up.
Right, oh, yeah. Right. There's a hold up. I'm like, what is he talking about? Yeah. Yeah.
Why is this a trope? Why are there lots
of holdups? Yeah.
On early 90s shows, people were getting held up left and right without any like fucking dramatic PTSD circumstances involved in it at all.
Absolutely. And so there's a bit of a Chekhov's gun type of theme in this episode too, because at the beginning of the pilot, there's a conversation between John and Mahalia where he's questioning why would he need to keep a gun in his office? And she just laughs and thinks it's hilarious that he doesn't understand why he would need a gun for protection. And sure enough, near the end of the pilot, he gets held up at gunpoint. And then I'll note this one other plot point. This is the denouement of the pilot, where he ends up taking the gun to bring it into his office. He goes into his office. You can hear in the rest of the station this gunshot echo out, and it sets it up as this very dark joke.
Yeah, you think he might have, like, yeah, sorry.
It cuts to reactions of everyone else in the station that they think he might have just shot himself. And then it turns out that he comes out of the office holding, if I'm not mistaken, the neck of a smashed liquor bottle because he was tempted to turn to alcohol earlier in the story, and he's shot this liquor bottle to destroy it.
This is, yeah. Well, and they have reasons for their reactions. Two of the previous managers had killed themselves.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Which, again, dark.
Speaking of which, yeah. The Mahalia character is also very strong, and they do a great job through her of using a lot of expository dialogue to set up this world in a way that feels quite organic.
Yeah,
in the way that she does
it's not contrived. It's really well overall. It's just really well written. I thought it was really well constructed, and all the dialogue. It's like, yeah, that gives you enough expository information without it being heavy-handed, or like the only things that are heavy-handed are the fact that it's called the Crossroads Terminal and that his last name is Hemingway.
But it's funny because like I'm glad you guys mentioned it. Never once caught the Crossroads thing ever. No, like I didn't hear them call it that ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So why don't we get into the retool of the John and Larroquette show?
Let's do it.
Yeah. To back it up, I'd like to talk about the creator of the show. So Don Rio is someone who was already quite successful in the TV world at the time. He's kind of known to create shows around existing talent. Like that's kind of his shtick. He's big on creating vehicle shows for known entities or comedians. He created shows like Pearl, which was a Rhea Perlman sitcom. And later on, he did My Wife and Kids, which was a vehicle for Damon Wayans. So basically, this was a golden opportunity for him to create another vehicle for a super talented and popular person, John Larroquette. So they came together to create this show. And of course, it's super edgy, right? It definitely was very sophisticated in how it was written and a lot of the character development as well. And by season two, unfortunately, it didn't really have a dedicated fan base or huge audience. And NBC was basically ready to cancel it. And John Larroquette really believed in the show, so he kind of did a Hail Mary and said, okay, if we just kind of retool it a bit, we can get a bigger audience and we can keep it going. Like, just work with us here. And they agreed to it. And essentially, the retooling was very much what we saw with It's Your Move, where they took away every ounce of edginess that existed and sanded off all the dark edges, or sanded off all the sharp edges, I should say. So basically, at the start of the third season, John Larroquette's character moves out of his like really grimy bachelor pad to a nicer new apartment, and his across the way neighbor is a nurse who ends up being his new love interest, and he goes to the day shift. So he's no longer night manager for seasons 3 and 4, and the set is visibly brighter. Many of the elements that we liked that were gritty from season 1 no longer existed. So while the writing is still good and there's still a bit of edgy humor, a vast majority of it is wiped out and things are sanitized to be more digestible for a primetime NBC audience.
Yeah, and I'll say that I enjoyed season 3, episode 17, but for very different reasons than why I liked the pilot. And it kind of felt like they were two different shows. And I didn't know any of the explanation that you just gave. And I didn't know that it was officially retooled at the time that I watched it. And one thing that I neglected to mention earlier is that I get 1 point for the comparison to Night Court because he was the night manager of this bus terminal.
Okay.
So it is almost Aaron. As if they kept him working at night.
Yeah.
Yeah. I when you were talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, like Night Court.
Yeah, but as like, you know, after season 2, he becomes the day manager. Another major element that's changed is Gigi Rice, the sex worker. She buys the bar that's in the terminal. It's to appease a more conventional audience. And which is unfortunate. Like, I don't know, understand why she had to go to, yeah, to a different type of work.
To appease a more conservative audience.
Yeah. And then ultimately, he doesn't really pursue a relationship with her because there was a bit of a flirtation in the earlier seasons between the two of them. And he kind of becomes interested in this nurse character who's played by, well, her character's name is Catherine Merrick, and she's played by Allison Lapaca. So that becomes his primary love interest going forward. So now we'll move on to the second episode that we watched of The John Larroquette Show, which was season 3, episode 17. Barry, I can tell you're very excited to talk about this episode.
I loved this episode. I really loved it. I thought it was a brilliant piece of comedy and a wonderful, wonderful parody.
Yes, I agree. So basically, in this episode, it's a full-on parody of Sunset Boulevard, the classic film noir.
Chef's kiss. Mwah, perfect parody.
It even opens on the exact same super famous shot from the beginning of Sunset Boulevard, except now it's instead of William Holden, it's got John Larroquette floating face down in what we don't know until the end of it, but is a pool in the middle of the bus station.
Yeah, I love the moment where he's like, is a pool here?
That was a great throwaway. And then, of course, the piece de resistance, if you're going to do a parody of Sunset Boulevard and you need somebody to play the Gloria Swanson role, oh my God, you just call Betty White and tell her to play herself as a post-Golden Girls, like, teetering on insanity version of herself. Oh my God, I loved it.
She won it.
She won one of her 5 Emmys for this.
Yeah. And deservedly so, because it was so funny. She plays the comparative Norma Desmond character. So she plays herself. Betty White plays Betty White post Golden Girls, and she is looking for someone to help her with with a project, a vanity project that is Golden Girls the musical. And our main character, John Hemingway, he's trying to be a writer. He's trying to write, like, think pieces for magazines and newspapers. So he, for whatever reason, it's very unclear as to how he even gets this opportunity, but he randomly gets this opportunity to interview Betty White at a book signing. So this is what kicks off their, like, weird interactions. And she's basically playing herself, but a delusional, egotistical, egomaniac version of herself.
You know what it reminded me of? If you've seen the show Extras, specifically the Patrick Stewart episode of Extras, where he's this egomaniac caricature of himself who has some sort of vanity project screenplay and he's forcing other people to hear about it. And you can tell that he has no idea what he's doing and you just have to sit through it.
Yeah.
But the plot of this one keeps getting better and better because she doesn't care about Golden Girls, the musical. It's just something that her and Rue McClanahan do to land men.
Yeah.
Young writer men, and they just
there's basically this implication that she's a black widow and that she kind of really warms up to John right away and wants to make him the next Mr. Betty White, and
just the reoccurring bits with Estelle Getty as her servant because she lost a poker game to Betty White.
Yeah.
And about how Betty White and Rue McClanahan just pass Estelle Getty back and forth as
their servant.
Oh, I did not get the parody reference right away.
Yeah.
But I was immediately enchanted with the kind of metatextual jokes around the Golden Girls. And I love that they followed up on some of them in all sorts of, like, new and expanding ways. The TV Guide close-up box joke, which was...
As soon as she said it, I was like, oh, I know where the payoff for this is.
Because
I'm ready for my close-up box.
Yeah, and I didn't know that was coming before because I didn't get the reference right away, but I was already laughing at the idea that she's so obsessed with how many times she's been featured in TV Guide, which is close-up funny enough box. On its own. And yeah. And the joke about laugh tracks in sitcoms and yes. how with the right laugh track, anything can seem like it's funny. And they did the 1-2 punch joke where she says that joke and you get the anticipated bit where there's a huge laugh, which they're yeah. obviously doing meta. And yeah. then the camera cuts over and there's Estelle Getty operating the laugh track rig.
Oh, man, that was good.
It was very funny. I had a lot of laugh out loud moments. Like,
I was not surprised to see that both Mitch Hurwitz and Jim Vallehi had yes. co-writing credits on this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mitch Hurwitz, man. Who, if people don't know, is one of the creators of Arrested Development.
Yeah, and Jim Vallehi is one of the long-term writers on Arrested yes. Development as well.
Yeah, so a lot of really funny, ridiculous humor of people making fun of themselves and, like, capturing, you know, that perfect combo of buffoonery and egomania. Like, those two things come together so yeah. perfectly. You know, like, we go into Betty White's apartment or condo and her Emmys are just laid out on the coffee table. Like, well,
there's a great joke about that too, because she invites him back to her hotel room and then they get into this space that has these awards littered everywhere.
Yeah.
So one of my notes yeah. is, why does her hotel suite have all of her awards on display? That doesn't make sense. Like, is that sloppy writing?
Yeah.
It was not sloppy writing, because they follow that up with him asking that exact question. And that's really where this Sunset Boulevard parody starts to unfold, because then we realize, no, it's a hotel suite and she's living yeah. in a hotel suite.
Yeah.
And she is surrounded in awards.
She does this line where she says, like, oh, those, I haven't looked at those in years. And he says, didn't you just check in this morning?
Yeah. They play with this so well.
It's great. It's really great. And Dexter is the one that points out that it's actually a parody of Sunset Boulevard, which is kind of funny. And it sort of aligns with this idea that John and Dexter throughout the series kind of give each other helpful hints. Like, when they see things for what they are, and they're like, hey, just so you know, you're in a parody of Sunset Boulevard right now. And it didn't end well for William Holden. Like, it was gold. Yeah. It was like a great way to use their dynamic to mm-hmm. point out something especially absurd.
And actually, that element of their relationship is probably the one major holdover from the original premise that we yeah. saw in yeah. the pilot.
Yeah.
Because the pilot culminates in John giving Dexter this tip on how he's being grifted by this other con artist. And yeah. it turns out that that was true
yeah.
and helps him avoid getting conned out of a couple $100. And yeah, this is kind of a similar
thing. It shows their mutual respect for each other and that they are willing to, like, be like, hey, just so you know, like, I yeah. can see something that you can't right now.
Yeah, here's what's going on here.
Dexter doesn't have a big role in this episode, yeah. but the other one that I accidentally started watching, which I only turned off because I was like, Betty White's not in this. I'm watching the wrong episode. They at this point in the series, have very much settled into being really good friends. They still give each other a lot of shit, but I thought it was interesting. The other episode, it was just the two of them go to, like, a book signing of this author they both really like. And I was like, oh, they've really moved this relationship into something.
Yeah.
My notes for this episode are such a mess because I have this stream of consciousness of asking questions as it's going along before mm-hmm. I picked up on the deliberate element of parody. So one of my notes is so many questions, ! Because I'm like, Betty White as herself. Now we have Estelle Getty as herself. What is happening? And then all of these meta jokes, which I'm like, okay, I'm loving that there's meta jokes and that they're playing themselves, but where are they driving at with yeah. all of this? So I also noted that this reminded me a bit of the situation with Golden Palace, where we have three of the four Golden Girls, but Dorothy is absent.
Yeah, I cut that too.
But they yeah. also follow up on that with a really funny gag about how they need someone to play Dorothy in this musical.
That they're previewing in the bus terminal of all places.
Yeah. It's like a little stage
setup.
They're
like workshopping it in the terminal.
It's the backers preview where they're trying to get people to invest in it.
Yeah.
It's actually very funny.
It's so funny. And so Catherine volunteers to play the Dorothy character. And clearly, you know, Betty White doesn't want Catherine involved because she can tell that, you know, like, oh, there's something going on between them and she's going to be a distraction for John. And, you know, and also probably she's much younger. So she doesn't want like her, a younger woman on stage. So she like locks her in a utility closet. And then eventually John plays Dorothy. It's just wild. Yeah.
He's doing like a kind of like a low rent, deep voice B. Arthur impression, yeah. Which is not, he's not laying it on thick, but it's yeah. funny. It's funny enough that it made me laugh.
Yeah.
And yeah, Catherine is assuming that I feel bad. I love the movie, but I didn't know the actress's name off the top of my head. But yeah, Catherine assumes the Nancy Olsen role where she is the young other writer who is yes. taking him away from
yeah.
from Norma.
Yeah.
And she gets jealous of her. And oh, it's so yeah. good.
And the episode kind of ends in a way that actually develops other parts of the season, in that he admits in that moment that he's developing romantic feelings yeah. for Catherine, and she overhears this. So although it's a silly kind of, I don't know if you'd call it a bottle episode, but it's like a very kind of strange, like parody episode, it actually does have some further series development that happens as a result.
Yeah, it's definitely, oh man, is it. I was so on board with it from the first shot. I was like, and at first I was just like, you know, I've seen a few shows open with the Sunset Boulevard gag before. It's a yes. fun, it's an easy writer's trick
to parody.
Yeah, it's an easy writer's joke, you know, somebody's floating face down in water and they're doing like really over dramatic voiceover, and then, you know, and then you flash back. At no point did I I was like 2-3 minutes in after that, like I wrote down, I was like, oh wow, what a great Sunset Boulevard like opening parody. And then we're 5 minutes in and I was like, oh my god, this whole episode is just going to be the plot of Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
This is brilliant.
Did you guys catch what the explanation for the kiddie pool was?
I don't think there was one.
Yes, there was. It was the capper to the gag about the bucket. First he got a small bucket, and then he got a bigger bucket because there was a leak, and then they were like, we need something bigger, there's a leak, because they don't want to fix the leak. And finally it just cuts to somebody just put a kiddie pool under it.
Yeah.
I missed that, and I wish I hadn't missed that, because that's a very funny gag.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned it, there's just a great line of they're walking by it and he doesn't stop. He just says, is there a pool in here now? But he just keeps going.
Yeah, just keeps walking. So although in the original discussion of the retooling, I was not super on board for them sanding off the sharper edges of the original yeah. premise. And I really quite liked where this series began in the pilot with this mm-hmm. guy who's trying to piece his life back together, and all of the themes that they explore in this bus terminal at night. I have to admit that this particular episode
yeah.
lands really well.
Yeah, if this was the result, it's not entirely unwanted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The only thing that really bumped for me in this episode was John's attire, because just that idea that he's a writer, so he's wearing the like black shirt and olive sport jacket and somehow is getting this opportunity out of nowhere to be interviewing Betty White. Like, that made no sense.
I mean, maybe
Catherine got it for him,
okay.
But they never really explain exactly
but
how.
Maybe it's earlier in the season. Like, maybe it's a thing where he sort of gets a contact to do freelance work for a particular paper. I don't know.
Yeah. But again, I think it...
But it feels like it's out of nowhere, because we're just watching it and we're like, really? Really, dude?
Much better hair. Maybe they were just rewarding him for his better hair.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, it's out of nowhere, but this whole episode is a very heavy suspension of disbelief type of plot. And mm-hmm. so it's totally fine in this episode. It's just jarringly different from the way the series began in the pilot. So I guess my question, and I don't know if there's an answer for this, but which is the better show?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say because we are not, we're not watching a regular show from one of the later seasons. We're watching a very special, you know, a very special episode.
But did they do that many times?
I don't know.
Who's to say, you know, who's to say that they weren't doing these zany adventures, you know, throughout season three? We weren't watching it, right?
We didn't watch enough. I mean, we could do a second episode just about this show.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me very distinctly, now specifically this Betty White episode, it reminds me very specifically of when Community started doing concept episodes.
Right, like, high concept episodes, yeah.
It's like a regular cookie cutter, you know, sitcom set in a college. You know, it's well shot, but then out of nowhere, there's an episode where it's just a pitch perfect Goodfellas parody. And like, it reminded me so much of, I was like, oh yeah, because they just commit to the bit. And like, yeah, oh God. I mean, there's this running gag in this episode that like kills me, and is like Betty White is trying to, you know, buy John's love.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She keeps giving him gold things. And then there's like, you know, she gives him a gold watch, and then you know, a gold pen, and then a gold frame of a picture of her holding a gold bar. And then my favorite is, and they don't even comment on it at the end of the episode, she's wearing a solid gold coat.
I didn't see that even. Yeah.
There was a joke where it's like, I think she's running out of gold to give out or something.
She makes a joke where she's like, I could have sworn I had more gold on me or something like that. And there's a joke where she gives him a set of dangly earrings. And she's like, I guess this is the only gold I have left handy.
It's so good.
And the Betty White of this show is such a funny caricature of herself.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Hats off to Betty White for crushing this role.
She crushes everything. When she's used well,
yeah.
Like, it's just, it is everything. It's like, there's no one who has done TV comedy better. Like,
this is Betty White already. This is Betty White in her early 70s already, too.
Oh, and speaking of age, one of the other great jokes was when she was pitching the idea of the Golden Girls musical. John asks, he reads the script and he's like, why aren't any of the other women featured much in this? And she just kind of laughs it off. And her response is that it wouldn't even really make sense because they're so much older than her, like because of the drastic age difference, that it's as if they're kind of no longer relevant or no longer around to be featured in it. And it's a great play on the fact that like there were these age differences between the performers in the show, but like she's the old one.
But I love, he goes, what about the other Golden Girls? And he goes, oh, who, the old women?
Yeah.
She goes, She said she was 30 years younger than them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just perfect.
Given that this show initially ran for a couple years, then went through a retooling, ran for a couple years longer, I'm curious why it didn't last longer or develop a bigger audience.
It's really smart. Not in a way that like I'm even looking down on people who don't get it. Like it is telling really specific stories.
Yeah.
Is there a market out there for a really elaborate Sunset Boulevard parody that only feels the need to explain the joke 3/4 of the way through the episode?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I have the exact same feelings about it. I just think it was too sophisticated and for a mainstream network audience. You know, it's similar to Hi, Honey, I'm Home. Like, brilliant. Yeah. And like, we are the audience. Like, we're nerds. We know the references. We get it.
Critics loved it. Like, you know,
they
like,
did, totally.
It was lauded with a praise, rightfully so. But like, yeah, the first version of the show is very, very smart and very, very dark. And I could see it being very hard to watch for a lot of audiences. So I get that.
Yeah.
And the second version of the show is really, really smart, but really, really zany and really specific.
Yeah.
So
I think it could have had a home that was more, you know, hospitable on a cable network or, you know, in streaming times.
What's that line? Something isn't beautiful because it lasts. You know, I don't need this show to go on 10 years and run itself into the ground. I'm really wanting to, I'm like, hey, it looks like there's four seasons of this. I'm going to watch as much as this as I can.
Yeah.
I don't need, you know, I don't need an 11 season Frasier.
It should be noted that, like, in my research for this episode, I did see some kind of glimmers of a cult following online. Like, there was lots of people who write about pop culture writing about this show. But yes, it's not on the main searches at all. Like, you have to go real deep in the internet to find it. But there is a fan base out there. There is a cult fan base.
Absolutely.
But I would argue that it should be a bigger cult fan base.
So if I'm understanding both of you correctly, what we watched were two different John Larroquette shows, both of which were ahead of their time.
Yeah, I would say so.
Very much so. This pairs, like Bryn said, this pairs really well with Sports Night because it is just, it's really smart, but it's also really, really different.
Yeah.
You know, I think the cult followings, like, I've seen this show brought up as well in pop culture writing because, yeah, it is just, it's that weird and different.
And to follow up on where I began with this show, I wish younger me had seen more than whatever 1 minute of this show that I saw, because both versions of this show are things that I probably would have enjoyed if I understood what was actually going on at the time.
Young me would not have known what to make of this.
No.
Yeah.
And me neither.
And the one last thing I'll say is that this is more in reference to the post-retooling and the Sunset Boulevard parody, but a show of that era that did parodies really well was The Simpsons. And one of the great things that they always did was they stacked the layers in their episode so that if you missed that element, if it went over your head, there was still plenty there for you, especially for kids, that there were other things that you'd enjoy. And that extra level of sophistication was there for the people who got it. This is not that kind of show that is prepared to spoon feed other elements to you. If you don't get the like main thrust of what's going on, then your head's going to spin a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point.
So Bryn, why don't you give us a 6 degrees of Friends on the John Larroquette Show?
With pleasure. First of all, the John Larroquette Show is separated from the iconic sitcom Friends by 1 degree.
Ooh.
Allison Lapaca.
Sounds about right.
Who plays Catherine Merrick on The John Larroquette Show, had a reoccurring role on Friends as one of Rachel's bosses, Joanna.
Well, that was easy.
That's who that was. It was bothering me. That's who that was.
The one that is kind
she's
of
the one that
she has a thing for Chandler and handcuffs him to a bed. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's a memorable role in Friends.
I think it's her desk, because Rachel's there.
Okay. Either way, Chandler is handcuffed, and it is very awkward. It's also separated by 2 degrees through John Larroquette.
All right.
John Larroquette had a reoccurring role in the short-lived sitcom Joey, which was the Friends spinoff, starring Matt LeBlanc.
Awesome.
And then Matt LeBlanc, of course, was the same character in Friends, Joey Tribbiani.
On to the spinoff.
Right. So I guess the short answer to this is that everyone that was in the John Larroquette Show was already successful, and they went on to continue to be successful. So first of all, there's John Larroquette. At the start of the series, the John Larroquette Show, he was basically the king of 90s TV. He had gotten 4 Emmys 4 years in a row for his role in Night Court. Aaron, you were saying something before about how he basically wrote to the committee because he didn't want to win again.
Yeah, I did a little bit of research into John Larroquette, and one nugget I discovered was that after winning Emmys 4 years in a row, he actually told the, I guess, network or studio that he did not want them submitting him for consideration anymore, at least not for that character. I guess because he felt like it would be maybe taking something away from other actors to just keep scooping up these awards.
Oh.
At this point, he was peak career. Like, he was killing it. He couldn't do anything wrong. And that's probably why the John Lee Arquette show lasted so long. He went on to continue to work in television. You know, he didn't have as many starring roles, but he was definitely working solidly and steadily. He earned another 2 Emmy nominations for his role in The Practice, and he won for one of those nominations in 1997. He has been in so many legal-themed shows, including Night Court, as we mentioned, The Practice, Boston Legal, and he even played a lawyer in a guest role on Dave's World. His most recent role is in The Good Fight, which is a legal drama as well. And so Daryl Mitchell, who played Dexter, he's widely known in Hollywood and credited often as Daryl Chill Mitchell.
Including in this, yeah. He was credited as Chill Mitchell.
Which is iconic. He also achieved a ton of success before and after the John Larroquette show. He was in many films and television shows across a variety of genres. Like, he didn't get typecast at all. He's definitely a guy who can kind of, you know, he's like a Swiss Army knife. He can do any kind of role. He's super talented, obviously. A memorable role for us 30-somethings was the role of Mr. Morgan in 10 Things I Hate About You, Julia Stiles' English teacher.
Familiar with the film.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And recent memorable roles include playing Wendell on Fear of the Walking Dead and Patton Plame on NCIS New Orleans. Liz Torres, also successful already, continued to be successful. She's an icon. She has a huge list of credits. One notable role that I'd love to shout out is as Miss Patty on Gilmore Girls. Catherine Merrick and Carly Watkins, who played both of John Larroquette's love interests in the shows, continued to work as well. I immediately recognized Carly Watkins as one of the gold diggers from the movie Night at the Roxbury.
Oh, thank you. Yep, that also was bothering me. Yep, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so, as we mentioned, you know, the writers of the show went on to do bigger and better, more exciting things like Arrested Development. Don Rio, the creator, has continued to write TV for decades. And his most successful writing credits after the John Larroquette show include 2 and a Half Men. And most recently, he created The Ranch for Netflix.
So, Barry, as usual, you are a producer in the 1990s, and I'm a network executive. Pitch me the John Larroquette show.
Hey, Aaron.
Huh?
Your office told me you would be here at the dentist. Have I got a show for you?
Oh.
No, don't get up. So it's got John Larroquette, right? We got him off the Night Court. We gotta get a show on the air right away, or we're gonna lose this guy. He's young, he's hot, well, he's relatively young. He's relatively hot, but oh man, is it going to be a great show. It's going to be called, I don't know, we'll come up with a real title later, but right now let's just call it The John Larroquette Show.
Oh.
All right, so he's a writer, right? I don't know. I'm not good with character names. Right now we'll just call him, John Hemingway. Hemingway, that's the name. We'll come up with something later, you know? Obviously, that's not the real name. We'll just find and replace it all later in the script. He's a writer, and he's an alcoholic, and he's suffering. He's suffering, and now he's going to run a bus station, and he's going to come up against all kinds of kooky characters who are also going through really, really, really hard times at home right now. And, you know, they're going to talk about life and how complex and beautiful and dark it is, and how, you know, sometimes we just need to. All right, great.
So we usually end our episodes on a moral, but since we're now teasing our shows with our first reactions, I thought we could follow that up with a first and final. So this is our final thoughts on the show.
It was way ahead of its time.
I don't know if there was a time. I don't even know if we've hit that time yet.
If we're judging purely on a laughter basis, this is comedically the most successful show we've examined so far.
Agreed.
Yeah, yeah. I'll go with that for sure. I laughed quite a bit in both episodes for very, very different reasons.
And cut to credits. That Was a Show is a production of Radio Gizmo. Subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and follow us on Instagram for info about upcoming episodes. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends about it.
Next time on That Was a Show.
So first reactions.
I was glad to see Cloris Leachman not once, but twice, and I was hoping for a third.
It takes place in a hotel?
This show seems to be attempting an entirely dad joke-based genre of comedy.
Radio Gizmo.